Getting back into the study of geography, we did a review 2 weeks ago when we were here before Thanksgiving. Before the world began, what happened? God had a great plan. And he started telling the plan to the first fathers, and he picked one first father named Abraham, and he told Abraham 3 things. I'm going to make you a big family, give you a special land to live in, and through your children is going to come a great blessing for everybody. But the initial problem was Abram and Sarah were childless, and what else were they?
Old.
They were old. 75 and 65 when they first received the promise. I just turned 50 this year. Cannot imagine having another one. Love children, but I just can't imagine. Besides adding another 15 years onto my time before I thought about it. But God does bless them with a child. It takes quite a number of years to have that blessing bestowed on them. Abram is 100 and Sarah's 90 by the time they have Isaac. And then Isaac grows up and Isaac has Jacob and Esau. And Jacob and Esau grow up and they have all their issues with the birthright and tricking the father into giving the blessing to Jacob, the younger one. And Jacob goes off to Haran, back to the land where Abram initially went to. Because remember, when he first got the promise of all these things, God had told him to get up and leave the family and go to a land that he would show him. He was down in Ur of the Chaldees, which was down there in the Euphrates and Tigris River area, a little south of there. And they were to go to a land that they would show him. So they pack up, he and his dad and Sarah and Lot. And so they head north up to Haran. And they're up in Haran. And they stay there for a while. And then finally, after his dad dies, God tells him, go on. I told you to go, and that's not the land I was going to show you. Let's keep on going. So they head on to the Canaan area. They get to Canaan, and there's a famine going on. So they wind up down in Egypt, and then they come back up from Egypt. And so there's a lot of things that have gone on during this time period. But Jacob winds up going back to get a wife from the family's area up in Haran, okay, which is at the north side of the Euphrates River, up in that area. So Jacob has 12 sons. Esau has some too, but Jacob has 12 sons. And then Joseph is sold into slavery down in Egypt. And after many years, they find him down in Egypt, and he sends for his dad, and they all move down to the land of Goshen, which is the best land in Egypt. And during that time period, God fulfills that promise that I'm going to give you a big family. When they leave, that's we had gotten them out of the land of Egypt a few weeks ago. When they leave, how many men that were 20 years and up were there? 603,550. Okay, there was a lot of men that were 20 years and up. Then the women, and then all the children that were under 20. A lot of people. That's a big nation. And that's what had caused the Pharaoh, the new Pharaoh that didn't know what Joseph and his family had done for them, for Egypt, to save them through the big famine. They knew that if these people turn against us, we're in trouble. It's a mighty nation. And so they come up out of Egypt as a big nation, and then God's going to send them to the land that they are promised. But he doesn't take them to the way of, remember what I called it? The way of, surely this is the way we'll go, because it's the shortest way to get there. The way of sure, on the northern side, God didn't take them that way. They could have been at the land of promise within just weeks. But he takes them down through the way of sin, the wilderness of sin. And why did he take them down there? Several reasons, but
he knew they weren't ready.
They weren't ready. What they had been in Egypt for 400 years, had they been faithfully serving the way God had intended for them to serve Him? No.
Nor were they soldiers. I mean,
right.
And they weren't soldiers. They weren't ready for battle. Now, did God need them to be prepared men? No, because God can win a battle with, let's say, a pitcher and a torch and a horn. God doesn't even need that. God won a battle against some people with just the sound of an army. Nothing physical, just the sound of them, and they all scattered like rats or something like that. I mean, they all scattered because they knew something was coming.
But God did want, from everything we can read and study, to have an independent, courageous nation who would fight their battles with His help and who would spread the fact that He was
right. And you said something that's very important, with His help. They needed to depend on Him. They come out, are there, you know, we go on a trip with several families maybe or something. When you stop somewhere, you gotta make sure that there's enough hotel rooms. You have to make sure that the restaurant that you go to has got enough space for you to sit together or something. There's a lot of things that go into planning a trip in our modern world that's full of conveniences. They had 603,550 men, and then all the women and all the children, and they were going through an area which didn't have restaurants and didn't have... somebody said something?
Hotel rooms,
yeah. They were going to be camping all the way, but they didn't have access to all the... They didn't even have access to a land that had crops on it. If they found somebody who was growing crops or something, if they did find somebody, it wouldn't have been theirs. It belongs to that person. So
they didn't even have the communication. You got 600,000 men. Somebody's up here. Somebody's way back there.
Yes.
You know, I mean, even just the logistics of letting everybody
traveling
know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yes.
Would be huge.
Yes. Very much so. So they go across, and then the army's coming after them. And so God fights that battle at the Red Sea, and the seas part, and they cross on dry land, and then the Egyptian army comes after them, and God covers them up with the water, and they all die in the sea. And then they come on down, and logistically you have the issue of, we've been 3 days without water. And so they come to the waters of Mamre, and or the waters of, I said that wrong, that's the trees of Mamre,
Mara,
bitter waters. And so God provides sweet water for them. And then they go on a little further, and there's lots of water. And then they go a little further, and God has to have Moses hit a rock to get water. Then they have a battle that they have to fight. Okay, so you have all that, and then they get down to Mount Sinai where God gives them the law. And God gives them their first real experience of His presence with them. Okay, Moses has already experienced His presence in the burning bush. Okay, but they get that first real experience with the thunder on the mountain, the fire and the smoke and lightning and all that stuff. And Moses goes up there and gets the law. And they play. And Moses breaks the Ten Commandment tablets, and he has to go back and get them again. And then God sends them on their way to go take the land. They go on up to the wilderness of Paran, and they're headed to take the land, and they go spy out the land, and they come back and they say, oh, can't do that. Why can't we go? Is it a bad land? No, it's good land. What's the problem?
Big people.
Giants in the land. Okay. We're grasshoppers in their sight. We're grasshoppers. That's what we feel about ourselves, and that's probably how they look at us. So they decide we'd rather go back to Egypt to be slaves. And again, God, you know, could have just with one whoosh wiped them off the face of the earth. But Moses pled for them, and God punishes them and has them wander in the wilderness. And so they wander in the wilderness, and they wander in the wilderness. And during that time period, that's in the book of Numbers, a lot of the stories of the wandering in the wilderness. The numbers are these 12, 40, and 3, Balak, Balaam, and his donkey. 12 spies go spy out the land, and 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And then the story of Balaam, Balak, and his donkey. Balak, the king of Moab, which is on the right side, the eastern side of the Jordan River, tries to, because now they're coming and they're starting to win a few battles, and God's winning them for them. And so they see this mighty nation coming up that's coming our way, and maybe we need to get somebody to curse them. And if we can get Balaam to curse them, then we'll be okay. And Balaam is kind of interested, to say the least. The greed, he's kind of interested. But God tells him, no, you can only say, you know, I don't want you to go. And so then they come back with offers of more. And still, he's not supposed to go with them unless they're there the next morning. Well, they're gone the next morning, and he chases after them. And then his donkey keeps him from getting killed. Okay? So, but also during that time period, Moses does something that causes him not to be able to enter the promised land. Struck the rock instead of speaking to the rock. And taking credit for what God was providing. How many times must we? We have nothing to do with it. God's supposed to be getting all the glory. In our lives today, how is it supposed to be? Are we supposed to take credit for things?
No.
In anything that we do, we're supposed to shine our lights before men that they may see what? The glory of God.
Glorify God.
That's right. And glorify God. Not that they can say, oh, hey, you know, Yvonne, you did a great job. Or Mary, you did a good job. Yeah. That's not supposed to be where we're at. Okay. So now we've gone up on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and we're going to be facing some of the people that Moses had told them about. So let's turn to Joshua 1. Okay. And we'll start in verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan. Now when we say go over this Jordan, what side of the Jordan River are they on? They're on the eastern side. So I'm going to come up from y'all's side. They're on the eastern side, and they've got to cross the Jordan to get back to the land of Canaan. Because the land of Canaan is that area, the strip of land that's between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. Okay. To the land which I'm giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, remember the mountains of Lebanon were up on the northern side. There were the two Lebanon mountains ranges. As far as the great river, the river Euphrates, that's the over on the east of the Jordan River, pretty far east of the Jordan River. It's not even on this map. All the land of the Hittites, and to the great sea going down toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance, and the land which I swore to their fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. Okay, what had Moses done just before this? Right before he died, the whole book of Deuteronomy is what? It's the law. And the word Deuteronomy, D-E-U-T, is how it starts with, D-E-U. Can y'all think of a word that we have in our language today that starts with D-E-U?
D-E-U.
Deuce?
Yeah. Duet.
Deuce.
The second part.
It's the second giving of the law. They've already been given the law the one time, and Moses is going to reiterate the law to them before he dies. And he gets up there and he tells them, there's blessings and there's cursings. There's, if you do this, I'll be with you. If you do this or don't do that, then I'm going to turn against you. Okay? So you have the second giving of the law, and then you have the death of Moses at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. Okay? So, now Moses is dead, and God's told Joshua, I want you to go take the land. I want us to notice the difference in attitude of the people this time, back 40 years ago or 38 years ago, when they were told to go take the land. What did they say? We can't do it. There's giants in the land. Now, have the giants disappeared?
No.
I wonder, and this is just speculation, but what do you think the parents, all the men 20 years and up, said to these kids as they were growing up all these years?
I was just thinking that. The reason we're here is because we didn't have the courage to do what God said to do.
Right.
So this generation has grown up knowing that what they need to do.
Yep. How many of you have ever traveled with young children in the back? What's the question that they ask about 10 minutes into the trip?
Are we there yet?
How much longer? Are we there yet? And not that I think necessarily that the children back then, we've talked about this, I don't think that the children back then were allowed to just complain as much, as freely as some of our children maybe. But I would think that that question at some point got asked. When are we going to be there? When are we going to get there? You told us that we were on our way to this land. When are we going to get there? How long does it take? Are we kind of going in circles? We've been at this place before. And so, you know, I could just see that probably in some of the family discussions that the reason why we're wandering around the wilderness and we can't go take the land is because we didn't do it when God said to do it. And we tried after he said, you can wander around the wilderness for 40 years. We tried. We went to take the land, and what happened? God wasn't with us. We were soundly defeated. We were routed. And so I would think that these children have grown up knowing that when God says something, we have to do it. We need to do it. We need to depend on God. They learned something that their parents hadn't learned when they needed to learn it. Okay. All right. Let's see if I can turn this around. All right. Moses earlier has listed 7 tribes that the Israelites were going to find living in the land of Canaan. You have the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, what is the one name that we generally call all of them?
Canaanites.
Okay. If it's called Canaanites, where do you think they came from? Okay, from the land of Canaan, or was there a person named Canaan? Go back in our memories. There was. But where do you think the land of Canaan probably got its name? From the person, Canaan. Okay, and so Canaan was one of the descendants of Ham. Okay, now if you'll go back and look at the map on... I can find it easily. Page 37. That gives us an overall picture of the yellow area is where Ham, the descendants of Ham, wound up. Now, we talk about Ham. Who is Ham?
Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Okay, so who are Shem, Ham, and Japheth?
Noah's
children. Noah's sons. Okay, so that's when all the inhabitants of the earth have totally been washed away, except for those eight souls. And now we're just scattered because originally we kind of hung out in one area and God had made them scatter. And so the descendants of Ham, they wind up going over to where what we call the land of Canaan, and then all down into Egypt and part south. There were still a little pocket of them that were back at Ur, the Chaldees, that Abraham had left there with them. In that area. So you have a little bit there. The descendants of Shem kind of stayed in that center part of it, the southern part of Asia Minor and the Arabia desert. And then you have the descendants of Japheth. Remember, they jumped over, and I say that figuratively just so that I can get it in my head, they jumped over those northern mountains and they stayed up northern away from the most of the Bible characters that we learn about. Okay, so the descendants of Ham are the ones that we're talking about. And the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, which are the of those, which one is the one that we learn about the most, that we have the most trouble with? The Amorites. They're always a thorn in the flesh of God's people. Okay, and then there were also giants in the land. They were called Anakim from the land of Anak, and Rephaim, Emmim, and Zamzumin. And I might not be pronouncing them right, but if I'm not, we'll... Okay? And so they were descendants of Ham through his sons Canaan, and they lived closely with the descendants of Shem in that Fertile Crescent area. Okay? All right. And of course, the name Canaanites, what we most frequently use it as a collective sense to include all the tribes. And the Amorites were the largest and the strongest of those tribes. Okay? And before Moses died, we've already conquered some of the ones on the eastern side of the Jordan, but it's not into the land of Canaan yet. But Sihon and Og. And what do we know about Og? He was big. And he was so big that his bed was 13 feet. Get over to the... See if I can find it. The Israelites had killed Og and taken his territory, and he was so large he had a bedstead of iron 13 feet long and 6 feet wide. We read that in Deuteronomy 3:11. Okay. Let's see. And also mentions that God had helped the Moabites and the Ammonites, Ammon with a O-N, drive out a lot of the giants from their area, from their land. So it was something that the people of God should have been able to count on, God helping them drive out everybody out of their land. Let's look real quick to make sure that we get some of the information that's in here. Mary, would you read the fourth paragraph down where it says the Ammonites or the Amorites were the largest?
The Amorites were the largest and strongest of the tribes. They who?
And this is page 66, the fourth paragraph down.
Out of the desert in the era immediate before God's first call to Abraham. That's about 2000 B.C. They swarmed over Aram, Mesopotamia, Canaan, and even Egypt, making their influence felt everywhere they went. We have already mentioned the Amorites in our note about Hyksos, king of Egypt, lesson 13. If the Hyksos kings were Amorites, as it is supposed that Amorites were ruling in Egypt and Babylon at the same time, their power over the whole area had waned from Joshua's day, but they still held sway over much of Canaan. The name is often used collectively to include all the tribes. See Genesis 15:16. the Israelites conquered two groups of Amorites on the east side of the Jordan before Moses died, Sihon and Og.
Okay. All right. Giselle, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Okay. Joshua 1:4 describes the land region from the Euphrates River to Mount Lebanon to the desert as all the land of the Hittites. The Hittites were descendants of Canaan through his son Heth. They established another kingdom along the Halys River in what was later called Asia Minor. Though they were separated from the Fertile Crescent by distance and mountains, they had close contacts with the people through commerce and raids southward. Egypt held control over the city-states of Canaan during the days of the patriarchs, but they considered the Hittites a constant threat to their northern edge. Groups of Hittites migrated through the region. Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah from the Hittite living in Hebron. Now Joshua's army will find them firmly entrenched in the central hill country.
Okay. All right, and if you look on page 42, that map shows that old Hittite kingdom that's way up there just south of the Black Sea. It has that Halys River. It's on page 42. So you see how far that the Hittites have gone away, but then they still had the area that they were still around God's people down there. And it talked about that they still had trade routes. They still did a lot of trading with them. So they were not just, they didn't just go off and leave, kind of like the Japheth and his group of people that you don't read much about them anymore. Okay. The other tribes listed, the Hivites, the Girgashites, Perizzites, Jebusites, were smaller and less powerful. And the Jebusite stronghold was the city of Jerusalem, or Jebus, and they were, it says, they proved to be particularly difficult for the Israelites to dislodge. Okay. All right. So the Hittites were still descendants of Canaan, which were all still descendants of Ham. So it's Ham, Canaan, and then Heth. And so they established this other area by Asia Minor. All right, and giants. Faith, can you read the next paragraph?
Giants were in the land before Abraham's death. The spies of Moses' day were terrified when they saw them. Moses told the Israelites God would help them drive all giants from their inheritance because he had already helped the Moabites and the Ammonites drive out those living in their lands. The Israelites killed Og and took his territory. Though he's so large, he had bedstead of iron, 13 feet long and 6 feet wide.
Okay. And Yvonne, would you read the next one?
The giants are called the sons of Anak and the descendants of Arda, a great man among the Anakims. No additional information is known of their ancestry. Possibly they were of the same bloodline as the other Canaanite tribes. Some have thought they may have predated the Canaanites in the land. Though their stature made them frightening, their number must have been small because their influence does not seem to have been widespread by Joshua's day. The Israelites had no trouble subduing the tribe. A small remnant of them found refuge in the cities of Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod on the Philistine plain. Goliath, who fought David, was from Gath. He was 9.5 feet tall.
Okay. And the Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod, that Philistine plain, remember that was the area that was right along the Mediterranean Sea. It was that narrow strip of land that was all over there. We also read about Gaza when the Ethiopian eunuch was on his, Philip was told to go to the onto the road that led to Gaza. Okay. All right. Would you be scared or frightened of giants? That's the natural thing to do. They would be. But again, they've had about 40 years to learn dependence on God. And hopefully this new batch of kids that have grown up and now they're the adults are going to have a little bit more faith in God. And they do. They do. Okay, so Joshua sends spies to cross the Jordan to the city of Jericho. Do you remember who they meet there?
Rahab.
Rahab. How is Rahab important to us?
She
She hid them.
She hid them? That's right.
Jesus' family too.
She's in Jesus' ancestry, the lineage of that. Yes, yes. Okay, so they go spy out the land, so they have to cross the Jordan River, and they go to Jericho and spy out the land. And what do we know, what does Rahab tell us about the people and the land, what they think of the Israelites? They're scared.
And they know that God's with them.
They've heard stories. They've heard these things, and they're... All the men are about to faint because of them. They're not happy at all. But she's willing. She wants to. She believes in that God. She believes that that what's happening is coming from God. And so she asks to be saved. And they come back and they are able to save her and her household. But she allows them to escape and get back. And so they've learned that they're terrified, and the Israelites are able to move forward with confidence. And remember, they cross over on dry land. They set up camp at Gilgal, which is southeast of Jericho, right across the Jordan River. They are going to be constantly coming back to Gilgal. That's going to be their main camp for a while. Okay, so Jericho is the first logical city to attack. Coming from Jericho, there were roads, trade routes that led down to Jerusalem and Hebron and up to Shechem area. Okay, so it's all in that central portion. It stands between them and where they need to go. Okay, how did we... Just briefly, how did we get the city of Jericho? So we marched around it, and then the foundation was sufficiently damaged that it just crumbled? The walls fell outward. That's right. And it was a miraculous thing. And the what seems foolish to men is what God can use to have his... I mean, maybe I didn't say that right. Sometimes we would think that that's not a good fighting strategy.
March around the city. I mean,
think about it. When you're marching around the city, you're vulnerable. So you've put yourself out there. They could stand on the walls of that city and... Of course, they didn't have like the automatic weapons that we have, but they had enough bow and arrow type instruments or stones that a lot of our people could have been wiped out just marching around the city.
They didn't make any noise either, did they? They're probably thinking, what in the world are they doing?
And it was early in the morning when they went through.
Right. And so they march around the city once a day for 6 days, and on the seventh day they march around the city. And you know that the people there in the city are expecting them to, okay, they're going to go back to camp now. And then, oh, what are they doing now? They're going, starting round two and starting round three. And they go around to the seventh time. And then, after that, then they shout and the priests have blown the trumpets and the walls fall down.
I can't even imagine the quick succession of thoughts of the people inside that city. Because like you said, they're expecting them to go back home or go back to their camp. Well, now they're going around and around again. So what's going
to happen? And now they're doing it again.
And how long could that have taken? I mean, they're going around the whole city.
Fortress covered 7 acres.
Yeah, so it's not a quick little thing that they're doing.
It's not like marching around this building.
No, and then suddenly there's this loud noise, trumpets, and then our fortress is gone. We were safe, now we're not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to have been a very frightening...
And so, and what do they do with all of the stuff in Jericho?
They destroyed most of it.
Right. There were certain things that were... Right. Yeah. But most of it got burned and destroyed. Okay?
Except Achan.
Do what?
Except Achan.
Well, yes, Achan had a little issue. So, Jericho's the first city in Canaan proper to fall to the Israelites. And I'm going to check my time and stuff. Okay, we got some more time. Okay, and so after that, they're on a high, they're on a roll, and they send some spies to Bethel, and they come back and they say, hey, that little village of Ai on the way to Bethel, we got this. Don't even need to send very many people. If we can do Jericho that we just did, this is going to be easy. So they, a small group, 3,000 people go, and what happens? Yeah, 36 die, and they get driven back. Okay? Calls to remembrance. I will be with you if you will obey my commandments. Why did they lose the battle? There was sin in the camp. That's the exact wording that was used. There was sin in the camp. And the sin was Achan had taken some of the forbidden things from the city and taken it for himself. And he had hidden it under his, in a hole under his tent. So it's like he knew. He knew he wasn't supposed to have that. But it was just too much of a temptation for him to... He just wanted it. He took silver and gold, and he took some of the beautiful garment, and God knew. It doesn't matter how small it is. I think I've told this before, but many people have said a similar thing. You know, sometimes you go to the grocery store and you realize that they maybe only rang up 9 of the 10 things that you had bought, and you say, wait, you need to, or maybe you didn't notice it until you're on the way out the door and you're going 1, 2, 3, 4, and you count it and you go, wait a minute, I got 10 and they only ring up 9. So you go up to the little customer service booth and you ask them to ring up that other one. Oh, well, why? You know, why are you doing that? Well, if I had never known that you had made a mistake, I don't know that God's going to hold me accountable to not knowing, but once I see it, it doesn't matter if it... I can remember back when we lived in Cleburne, Dr. Peppers were on sale for 19 cents a 2-liter. That was back 22 years ago. But it was on sale, and I bought 10 of them, and she only rang up 9. So I went to the service desk, and I said, you need to ring up this other... I was just 19 cents. And I looked at her and I said, I need to give you the money for it. Whatever you do with it is your business. But here's a quarter, because 19 cents is not worth missing out on heaven. And this shows you, it doesn't matter how big or how small it is, how well we try to hide it, it's not worth missing out on God's blessings. Because God would have been with them. They could have gone with one person to fight against that army. If God was with them, they would have won the battle. But because sin was in the camp, God said, I'm not going to be with you if you don't obey my commandments.
It's almost harder to go in and say you didn't charge me, or you overcharged me. I got money back one time that wasn't mine. I went back in, and the assistant manager of the store was there, and I said, you know, one day giving this money back. He took it and he looked at it like, what am I going to do
with it? Yeah, what do I do with it now? How do I undo?
That's your problem, not mine.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the whole thing. We have to live our lives the way God wants us to live it. If that creates a burden on somebody else to try to figure out how to handle the fact that we were honest, then that's something that they're just going to have to deal with. And maybe it'll make an impression on them years down the road that somebody cared enough to be truthful about something that really, in the big scheme of things, to them didn't seem like it mattered.
And another small thing, but when I'm in that situation and somebody at the cashier's desk says, oh, well, just never mind, I try to take the opportunity to say, but it's not yours to give away.
Yeah.
You're not the person that it belongs to.
Yeah.
So,
So, all right. So, they go through the whole process of getting down to who had sinned, and Achan is found, and he's stoned, and his whole family, everything is destroyed. What?
Everything he owned.
Everything that he owned, and all the people of his family.
Animals,
everything, yes, was all destroyed, stoned, and the people prepare for battle again.
The really important piece of the story, Nathan, that I think we don't emphasize enough, is that our sin can cause horrible consequences for other people.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. It sure can.
And I get very tired of young people who don't know yet say, it's my life. What I do, it's my life. It's only affecting me, and that's not true at all.
Right. Yeah. It affects a lot of people. Even if it doesn't physically affect them, most of us are old enough that you've had children that have disappointed you at one point or another.
Of course.
Whether, yeah, Tippy, you'll have to
let
just
me tell you the way.
But even when it's something maybe that physically doesn't affect us, you know, financially or whatever, maybe we don't, it's not our business anymore, they're grown or something, but heartache, the heartache that it causes us. Or, you know, hopefully most of you haven't had to face children being unfaithful as a continuous thing. Maybe they've made a mistake and they came back, but they maybe weren't. But the heartache that it affects you. I mean, you're trying to serve God and you taught them well, and why can't they, or why are they doing this? And then that can cause physical things to you. That can cause illnesses that so it doesn't matter if it's just you and you think it's not going to affect anybody else. It does. It affects our brothers and sisters in Christ. Giselle and I were talking on the way up here, that the church needs to be a family, and when one part of it's a body, and when one part of the body suffers, it should pain every other member of the congregation. And if it doesn't, then we need to take a gut check. We need to check things out and see if we're really truly as much a part of the body as we profess to be. So, anyway.
We care enough about each part of the body.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Body.
Yeah. So, once the sin was removed, they had no trouble defeating it, and then they continued on to the city of Bethel. And Ai was burned and left as a permanent heap. Okay. Now, Jericho's been destroyed, Ai and Bethel. And now they're able to freely move about. And there's a problem. Who comes up against them? Well, first of all, they go to the twin peaks, the Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Do y'all remember studying those? I think maybe we even had a picture of them when we studied those. They're the two mountains, and right in the valley is the city of Shechem. And Shechem is very important. Shechem is where Abram was given the promise. He goes back to Shechem a lot of times. But
it's where that slaughter happened. Over
Dinah. Yeah. The children of, or the sons of Jacob had an issue at Shechem. Joseph goes to find his brothers at Shechem. And so a lot of things happen at Shechem area. But there's a big mountain kind of hill on each side of it. And it creates kind of like a, what I would look at it almost like a amphitheater. And so they go there, and there's half of the tribes stand on one side on one of the mountains, and the other side, the other half stand on Ebal, and the Levites are down there in the middle, and the priests are down there in the middle, and they read the law. And then they stake their territory. This is the land that God had given us. And then you have the men from Gibeon, and they come and they want to have a treaty. They've come from a long way. What were God's people supposed to do about treaties with those people that lived there?
Don't do it.
They were not supposed to make any treaties with these people. And, but they trick them. How do they trick them, Faith?
They go in there and pretend they're from somewhere far off.
Well, how do they do that? How do they trick them? Old clothing that's all tattered. Moldy food in their little jars. And we've just come from this long way, and we just, you know, it wouldn't hurt to have a treaty with us. And so they make a treaty with them. We're far away. It's not going to really affect you. And come to find out, they're just right down the road. And when they find out, does that say, okay, well, you tricked us, so I don't have to fulfill my vow? No. I was talking with somebody this week about vows and like our marriage vows and things like that. It shows you how serious God is. When we make a commitment or a vow to do something, it doesn't matter if somebody tricked us. It doesn't matter if somebody got the better end of the deal and we need to back out of it. We're supposed to... I thought it was mine. We're supposed to know that we keep our vows. So they keep the vows, but they make them slaves.
Hello? Yes? Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's fine. So they make them slaves. But they still are going to keep their part of the commitment. They didn't ask God for help in the matter, and they wind up making a bad deal. And then you got the king of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedek. And he's heard about all these victories and he's not happy with it because he's next. You know, he's one of the fortified cities, but he's next. So he sends and tries to... hang on a second. He tries to get the kings of Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon to come and help him fight against these people. And does he immediately go and attack God's people? No, who does he attack? Gibeon. Gibeon's made the peace treaty with him. He attacks Gibeon. And when they go and attack Gibeon, Gibeon sends word to Joshua, we need help. And so all night long, the Israelites march from Gilgal to Gibeon, and they make a surprise attack and they win. And the Amorites are fleeing towards Beth Horon, Azekah, and Makeda. And you see Makeda on the map. And what happens when they get to Makeda? They have the big hailstorm that falls on the Amorites. Okay. And they're winning the battle, but it's getting dark. Or it's starting to... the sun's going to be going down. And if they are able to get away in the cover of darkness, what's going to happen? They're going to have to fight them again later on. So God has the sun stop so that they can finish the battle. And what happens to the five kings? Actually, they find them holed up in this cave. And so Joshua has them roll some big stones in there where they can't get out of the cave. And then they don't stop. They don't wait there and take care of the kings. They go ahead and fight the battles, and then they come back for the kings. And they kill them later. But while they have the advantage, they push through all the cities. Makeda, they kill the five kings. Libna, Lachish. And remember, Lachish is one of the ones that had come to help. Gezer, Eglon, they had come to help. Help the king of Jerusalem. Hebron, they had come to help. And Debir. So they go through all those areas and they destroy all those areas. And they don't leave half the city there. They destroy it all. Okay?
It's got to have been terrifying to live in Canaan at that point.
Yeah.
Because you know...
they're coming.
Yeah, they're coming and they're hearing these things. Although I have often wondered, how they're hearing these things. They're destroying the city and everybody in it. But well, traitors and spies. People coming through.
Yeah. Somebody's getting word out. Yeah. Somebody's getting word out. So then the kings of the north, we're going to go real fast to this. They form a coalition, and it's led by Jabin, the king of Hazor, which is up there kind of between the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula. Never remember how to pronounce it. And they gather a whole big army, and they gather over there at the waters of Merom. And they want to go fight. But what happens? Does Joshua wait for them to come to him? No. He goes and attacks them and defeats them, and they flee toward the north. And Joshua comes back and takes the city of Hazor. It's pretty much anybody who's coming against them, that's the first ones that city's going to be wiped off the face of the earth. They kill all the inhabitants, burn the city, and it was a major conquest. It had walls around 200 acres. It was a big city to conquer. And after the victory, there was no king or coalition of kings left to fight Israel. Okay, so they won. Okay. All right. I know it's time for the class to be over and stuff, but any questions or comments or thoughts about it?
I think it just must have been an amazing time to live in Israel. Although I guess they don't call it Israel at that point.
Right. God's people.
Because they have been, within a generation, they've been slaves.
Yes.
They've wandered. And now they're conquering everything. So this transition that these people under the age of 20 have gone through is pretty amazing.
And it all is based on their dependence on God. Now, were they perfect? No. Because at the end of Joshua, you're gonna remember him saying that if it seems evil for you this day to serve God, then you choose whom you're going to serve. Either the gods of your fathers on the other side of the Jordan, so other side of the river. That's all the way back over to and Haran and all that stuff. And so they served other gods back then. Or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you now dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And what did they tell him at the time? We want to do it. Oh, yes, count us in. We want to serve God. And what did he say? In a roundabout way, don't say it if you don't mean it. Because if you say you're going to do it, a vow. Okay, if you say you're going to do it and you don't, you make this covenant with God and you don't do it, he will turn from you and do you harm. All those things that were talked about in Deuteronomy. If you do my commandments, if you do my will, I'm going to be with you. And they've had all this time period for them to fight the battles against all these Canaanite people, the descendants of Ham. They've won many battles. They've also seen what happens when they don't serve God. So that generation's going to serve God. They're going to serve God through the generation that outlives Joshua. But then Judges happens.